to be involved in this discussion, I think you have to buy into the fact about one out of six cancers in human beings are due to an underlying infectious disease. And human papillomavirus and cervical cancer are probably the best example I can come up with of that underlying assumption. We've known for maybe a decade or more that nearly all cases of cervical cancer are due to a human papillomavirus infection. You can find HPV DNA in all those cervical cancers. And worldwide, cervical cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death for women, about 500,000 cases and about 250,000 deaths. In the United States, it's about 10,000 cases and about 3,000 deaths. As you know, the quadrivalent vaccine was approved last year, a little more than a year ago, by the FDA, and there have been some recommendations on how to use that vaccine in clinical use, and I'll discuss that. And then there's a bivalent vaccine, which I'm not really going to have time to talk about too much, that will probably be out in 2008. So here's what I'm going to try to cram into a few minutes of discussion. So briefly, the epidemiology of HPV, a little bit more about the burden of disease. There's actually a nice meta-analysis of the 9 published trials I'm going to refer you to, and I'm just going to go over the one trial that I was involved with that talks about premalignant disease as an endpoint as far as diseases. So I usually say when I talk about the epidemiology of HPV, it's pretty easy to talk about because most sexually active people get a human papillomavirus infection. This is a cross-sectional study from Ann Haynes data by Eileen Dunn and some colleagues at the CDC. And like most sexually transmitted infections, you would suspect that the peak prevalence is going to be teens and 20s, but there's that long tail out there. And these are self-collected vaginal swabs, and there's low risk and high risk there too, high risk being the oncogenic virus. There is a somewhat similar trial in the Journal of Infectious Disease a few weeks ago by Anna Giuliano's group, and she did males instead of females. And the data are about 20% higher on any one of those given bars. They sampled more sites, so I think it's probably a little bit of a self-selection process. And also, this is pretty much representative American data since it's from the Ann Haynes study, and Anna was looking for human volunteers to come in and get these extra samples. But you can see some of these bars are pretty high, even if you don't add another 10 or 20% on them. So there are a number of these incident infection studies. This is Rachel Weiner and Laura Kautsky and the group at University of Washington. This is one of those studies that's so darn simple you wish you would have thought of it first. So basically, she asked women as they came in for the first gynecological visit, a very typical thing to do in your late teen years, get started on birth control pills, maybe have your first pap smear, chlamydia test, do you want to be in my study? And then they were sampled every 6 months to see if they got an HPV infection. And you can see after 3 years of being sexually active, from the time they were first sexually active, was about 50%. There's some four-year data. Frequently when I'm in the audience and I see this there's four-year data that's up to about 60%. Everybody started graduating at that point, so the numbers aren't quite as big. Again, in that issue at JID from a few weeks ago from some of the same authors, there's a male curve that looks quite similar. Additionally, there's a British study, and I don't remember the authors, but the curve looks very similar. It's a little younger age group, but it's interesting because it's just one lifetime partner in these teenagers. So they only have one partner, but they're accumulating HPV infection quite rapidly. And so that was what I started out by saying. If you're sexually active, you're probably going to get this infection at some point during your life. So, of course, in the United States, we have cancer screening for a cervical screen, but it's very expensive to do that screening. It's about $3 billion a year for that, and that's doing pap smears, colposcopies, all those things that gynecologists do every day as a bread and butter type of thing. So cervical cancer in the United States is in poorly screened populations, and I haven't been at the whole meeting, but certainly just walking up and down the hall, there's lots about health disparities, so we're going to talk about that on my next slide. In a lot of the modeling exercises, there are estimated risk of infection. That's if everybody enters the HPV infected pool, how many at the end up having cancer? And it's only about 2 to 4%. And so certainly we know that most HPV infections never turn into any kind of clinical disease. There's a large part of people that 85% maybe that never have an abnormal pap, never have a genital wart, anything along that lines. Of course, they're out there passing the virus around. So that's the problem with that. Usually, you know, you see the iceberg about the people that are under the water. So, but we're out there doing pap smears and HPV tests trying to find these people. Here's this data from Montessori. This is from the official Journal of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Was published in the March edition. And this is data that talks about cancer in the pre-vaccine era was what the title was for this. And you can see the rates. So, and you can see we have two distinct populations in the United States, African-American women, urban African-American women, and Hispanic women. And so we have and in Georgia we have a lot of both of those. To make it even worse, I would guess the standard deviation around the Caucasian group is pretty darn wide because rural Caucasian women have a very high rate of cervical cancer, and some of the highest rates are certainly in areas where the population is overwhelmingly Caucasian, such as the Appalachian area of the United States. There's some other cancers I want to talk about. Obviously, I'm a little bit biased being a gynecologist to talk about cervical cancer screening, and that type of thing. But I wanted to show you this slide from the American Society for Colposcopy and Cervical Pathology that talks about the relative contribution of HPV plus the size of the bar is how many cases. And so you can see there cervical cancer is the biggest bar, and nearly 100% of cervical cancer is HPV related. But now we have some other cancers, anal cancers, vulvar cancer is known to be HPV related, especially in younger women, penile cancer, where you can see the bar is quite a bit smaller. Non-melanoma skin cancers have also been implicated in this. Of course, that would be a huge bar when we start talking about that. There was also an article in that May edition of the New England Journal of Medicine about head and neck cancers. And, you know, if you're a gynecologist, you probably slept through head and neck anatomy. But I think the point is that those cancers are being blamed more and more on one type of HPV, HPV-16. And so just to summarize everything I've said quickly, there are about 30 types of human papillomavirus that infect the genital tract. In the vaccine that's available in the United States, there are four types that are covered. And so 16 and 18 are the oncogenic types. They cause about 70% of cervical cancer, about 70% of high-grade disease or premalignant lesions. Gynecologists have a lot of names that mean the same thing. SIN23 is what I'll use from here on out. About HPV 16 especially is associated with vulvar and vaginal cancers, and then a lot of the more minor lesions, which we spend a lot of money trying to figure out whether those people really have high-grade disease, is due to 16 and 18. And then 6 and 11 causes a majority of genital warts. We would consider that a low-risk virus because it doesn't have much oncogenic potential, but it also contributes quite a bit to the pap smears, the minor pap smear abnormalities. Not really going to talk about men too much. The vaccine is really not used in men in the United States, so we will skip over that, but there's certainly some cancers there. These data are kind of abstracted from a supplement to the journal Vaccine, and I believe that was last fall, so there's a whole series of review articles, so if you only had access to one journal to learn everything you need to know about HPV, you'd probably choose that supplement. So let's talk about vaccines briefly here. So the HPV genome is pretty darn small. It's about 8,000 base pairs, has about a dozen or so genes, and one gene is the capsid protein. And so it self-assembles. I have a cartoon I'm going to show you into a three-dimensional structure that is very similar to the native virus. The name that is kind of stuck for this is virus-like particles, and GSK and Merck, the two companies that make this vaccine, also make hepatitis B vaccine, another surface protein vaccine using the same technology. So the dosing is 3 injections over a 6-month period. And when I first heard about these vaccines about 10 years ago, it was after animal work had been done, and there are some nice animal models for this vaccine that looked very good in the animal models and subsequently allowed us to pursue this. And so this is from Ian Fraser, one of the people that described the VLP originally, and so I stole this from him after I heard him give a talk last year. On your right is the native virus, and it's alive. You can tell because it has a red halo around it. So, and the DNA is there in the middle, and the L2 protein is kind of a scaffolding protein that's called the minor capsid protein. And in here is what's in the vaccine. So you can see the antibodies that recognize this are going to recognize that. And so that's the theory on how the vaccine works. And so there are lots of phase two and phase three studies to talk about. As I said, there are nine, and this meta-analysis in the Canadian Medical Association journal from the summer is what I'd probably point you to if you want to see all nine studies head-to-head. The important thing about the phase two studies are they're the longest studies, up to 5 years duration is the longest one that's been reported so far for both the quadrivalent and the bivalent vaccine. The efficacy studies that I'm going to present to you are mostly done in adolescents and college age women, and their exclusion criteria based on the number of lifetime partners and prior HPV-related diseases. And what I'm going to show you is HPV-naive patients. This is meant to be a prophylactic vaccine, not a therapeutic vaccine. And so here's one of those nine studies I'm going to present. This is the Future 2 study that was in the New England Journal of Medicine. And so this is a prospective, randomized, placebo-controlled trial with the red bars being the placebo and the yellowish bars being the vaccine. And as you can see in the protocol on your left, 98% effective. And then the modified intent to treat analysis is really people that didn't follow the protocol exactly like we wanted. Maybe they skipped some visits. Maybe they got infected in the middle of getting their vaccine and that type of thing. And so that's a little bit more real world, but you can see it's still well above 90% as far as efficacy. And the endpoint for this result for this trial was clinical disease, premalignant disease, which is something that a gynecologist would usually treat in the office, and that's how we prevent women from going on to cervical cancer. So what's going on now? Well, there are all these efficacy trials that were published this year. Then actually Sunday at the International Papillomavirus Society, there were some results from women who were 24 to 45. There's likely to be a trial of men reported next year as well. Quadrivalent vaccine is approved and recommended, and I'll go over that. The bivalent vaccine is likely to be approved next year. Here are some suggested questions we want to talk about. During the question and answer period, I mentioned duration of protection a little bit. Most of those other things we don't know as much about, so including herd immunity. This is the only single-gender vaccine we have, of course, in the United States. And so here's what the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices told us clinicians to do. So routine vaccination of girls 11 to 12 with three doses of the quadrivalent vaccine. There's some other vaccines given at that age. The vaccination series can go as young as 9 because that's how far the safety data goes down. And then this whole cohort of women who are adolescents, late adolescents, and early adulthood. As far as safety data, I just want to briefly mention this. The best data I know of available for this is on the CDC's website. I looked at it yesterday. If you just do HPV vaccine safety on their search, it'll lead you to this information. In a phase three study, about 1 out of 1,000 patients dropped out because of a serious adverse event, and almost everybody had sore arms. There are lots of pediatricians, of course, giving this vaccine with other vaccines. Apparently, this vaccine's a little more painful than other vaccines, and some anecdotal evidence. Dizziness appears to be more common in the post-marketing experience. There have been some reports in the VAERS data about Guillain-Barré, and there's been viral myocarditis in there as well, DVTs, PEs, but doesn't appear to be related to the vaccine, and the Guillain-Barré rate is less than baseline. So here are my conclusions. The majority of sexually active men and women will contract an HPV infection at some point in their life. Some, a minority of HPV infections persist, leading to premalignant disease as well as invasive cancers. The cofactors that get you from your initial HPV infection to the cancer are unknown, so we don't really have great risk groups that we can describe. And then there's this highly effective vaccine that's available. I also have some conflicts of interest I want to make clear to you guys. So I've worked with GSK and Merck both with their vaccine, and I'm also working with Avaxis with their potential therapeutic vaccine, and I've been involved in all kinds of policy and decision-making things for the CDC since they're next door to Emory. It's not very hard to do that, walk across the street and get through security. So, and the NIAID as well.